L is for the way
that's who you think it is. The and Grimace B mug. The Hello Kitty keychain. Barbie herself. For a limited time, your favorite McDonald's collectibles filled with memories and magic are now on collectible cups. Get one of six when you order a collector's meal at McDonald's with your choice of a Big Mac or 10-piece McNuggets. Come get your cup while you still can. And participate in McDonald's for a limited time while supplies last.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.
Hello everyone and welcome back to True Crime Tuesday, where of course we're taking a look at the Marconi deaths, otherwise dubbed the Marconi murders. But first and foremost, a huge thank you to all of the sleuths out there who pointed out, yes, True Crime Tuesday released on Wednesday last week, not my finest hour. But we all make mistakes, and not just podcast hosts. Secret Service people, possibly, I'm sure. MI5, most certainly. And whoever had a hand in the deaths of the 22 scientists working on these Cold War era weapons. Last week, we took a look at autoerotic asphyxiation. Or, to put it another way, a way that Secret Services can assassinate someone without it looking like a murder, and also dissuade any attempt of a further look into that death, solely down to the alleged perversion or depravity that surrounded that death. Now, you may recall we discussed the idea that they probably messed up themselves there with the fact that these two autoerotic asphyxiations happened within 4 months of each other, which would be highly unlikely for two people working in the same type of job. We also touched on the fact that in between the dates of those two deaths, there were another six deaths. Another six alleged suicides committed by people who all had links to the Marconi Defense Project. And we're going to take a look at four of those today. Unbelievably, when we finish this episode, we'll have already, in only four episodes, covered 12 deaths. And it's kind of unreal to think that when we've covered our third death today, we're only halfway there. Now, when you look at the methods, if we go down the line of these being murders and not suicides, when you go down the line of how these people were murdered, if that was the case, you really do have to question the invention, the creativity in these assassins' minds. Because last week's episode, we pointed out the consistencies of these autoerotic asphyxiation deaths and how they stood out like a sore thumb, especially being just 4 months apart. Now, today's episode will probably blow your mind in terms of if we follow the narrative of murder as opposed to suicide, how they went about doing it in between those two autoerotic asphyxiation deaths or sexual misadventure or whatever other tawdry tab they want to put on it so that nobody feels inclined to look. Sincerely, when you hear about these four deaths that all took place in between those 4 months, in fact, the deaths we will look at today all took place between January and February of 1987, 2 months. When you hear about them, to me anyway, It would appear the most obvious thing, if this is indeed all assassinations, is it sounds like there is almost a guidebook for how to carry out a suicide. How to suicide someone. As in, kill them yourself and make it look like a suicide. And this how-to guide is given out to Secret Service assassins as they begin. Now, from what we've looked at so far, I could only surmise that there are two relatively new and not in contact with each other assassins going around killing these scientists, and they're working their way through the methods of this book. However, they seem to be doing it at the same time, and in doing so, drawing more light on these deaths than they would if they would have done it any other way. Now, of course, as we do say on this show, we cannot rule out any sort of idea that these people had either suicidal ideation or depression, and that these are all genuine coincidental suicides. And if that's the case, this is beyond horrific. But we are looking at the idea that these were not suicides, they were murders due to what these individuals knew. What we can say is what we've seen so far, which is a pattern emerging. And that pattern is one which shows three things. The family and friends of all those deceased ones are saying they show no signs of depression, no signs of suicidal ideation, but also there was a slight increase in stress. But when psychologists looked at the amount of deaths and the amount of alleged stress, if we go down the suicide route, even they ruled this would be an unlikely number of suicides for work-related stress. Interestingly, there are three more things which are becoming a pattern also. Either 1, they're about to leave a Marconi-affiliated role. 2, they're about to begin a Marconi-affiliated role. Or 3, they've confided in friends that something has arrived in their workspace or on their work plate that has made the stakes of their job much higher. Frustratingly for us, they're either too afraid or wrapped up in the Official Secrets Act, which we've seen used almost weaponized earlier, or they feel a genuine responsibility towards national security so that they've never divulged what those higher stakes are. But the patterns are beginning to emerge. And that's why this entire conspiracy theory, and I do say that in inverted commas, has become almost a fixation for people who look into these things. Now, as I say, I'm not an investigative journalist. You may have picked that up during the last 3 episodes. But like I said in episode 1, when I watched that silent documentary about these deaths, my first thought was, how is this story, this idea, not up there in everyone's mind with the likes of JFK in terms of conspiracy? Well, I think there could be an answer to that. But in order to look at that answer, we do need to take a step in to the conspiracy sphere, if you will. Or should I say, a step further? And it's a very slippery step. You don't want to go down a rabbit hole in these things because you will only end up misinformed, misguided, and misunderstood. However, here's my theory. Even in the internet age, when obviously there is information out there, we're talking about it right now, if our government does not wish you to see something, they will do everything they can so that you don't. So that you're branded a conspiracy nut. So, let me use a real-world example, which is proven, and you can check this for yourself. Brexit. That wonderful conjoined word where over half of the population disagreed with another half of the population, yet right now, everybody's basically saying we were better off in the EU. One person who was desperate for us to leave the EU was, of course, our then Prime Minister, Boris Johnson. And he would do anything to try and get your vote, and indeed did, including infamously standing in front of a red double-decker bus with the slogan, If we left the EU, an additional £350 million a week would go into the NHS. That image was on the front page of every newspaper in the UK. And God knows how many votes that got in favour of leaving the EU. So, we leave the EU. And questions are asked about where this money is. Where is this £350 million per week? It turns out, through official fact checkers, it was never there. And the money we would save by leaving the EU was already earmarked for other places excluding the NHS. So, you were caught in a lie, Boris Johnson. That's a fact. So what did Boris do? Did he come out and say, I made a mistake? No, you can't do that as a leader of a country. Instead, what his spin people told him to do was, in the next number of interviews you have over X amount of weeks, apropos of nothing, ensure to slip in the fact that in your spare time, as a hobby, you like to get miniature London red buses and paint them. And whoa, wouldn't you know, now when you Google Boris Bus, you don't see that image of £350 million per week to the NHS. No, you're directed to an article about Boris's hobbies. And that is evidence of how they manipulate what we see. And therefore, what we see becomes our truth. So for cases as old as this, well, it would have been so much easier for them to remove what they needed to remove and to keep that an active thing as the internet progressed. There are many other ways that the government can manipulate what we perceive, and we could do an entire podcast just on that. For example, and I'll be very quick so we can move on to the matter at hand, but our disinformation vector, which, for example, David Icke and Alex Jones, somebody who has a reputation for spreading conspiracy theories. Now, it's been known, it's been proven that government officials in the secret capacity can go out to these individuals and give them facts. So let's say you see an actual UFO in the sky, okay? Now, if you're convinced you've seen it, the government will go to a David Icke, someone whose reputation is tarnished as being a bit insane, etc., and not always providing accurate information. So therefore, they will go and tell him a truth. They will say, there is a UFO in the area of X. He knows this person's legit, as in David Icke knows. So he goes out and says this. But automatically through association, that information will not be taken seriously. He's a disinformation vector, unwittingly employed by the Secret Service. Over the last few years, it's become knowledge we live in a post-truth era. We can no longer trust what we see, what we hear. The Marconi deaths, or if you will, the Marconi murders, as we theorise, occurred in what we would still consider to be, albeit falsely, the truth era. So imagine how hard they would have had to work to keep these deaths from common knowledge. However, there are two things going on. There seems to be a rush, an absolute peak, which we're right in the middle of on episode 4 of these deaths. Like a clean sweep needed to happen ASAP. And maybe it was the expedience that was needed, or maybe it was, as we posited earlier, simply two separate people with no communication between each other, which I would imagine would be common practice if you're an assassin, that inadvertently caused these suicides to have a spotlight shone upon them. Let's say, for example, there are four known assassination ways of suiciding someone. Is it more coincidental that two or three separate assassins working without each other's knowledge are given separate lists of names and have gone out, committed the suicide act, if you will, and they've chosen the same method, therefore drawing eyes and raising suspicions? Well, let me tell you, as we go on through this season, the coincidental suicides start to become almost farcical. And of course, I gather we're all intelligent enough when I use a phrase such as these suicides start to become looking farcical, I'm referring to the excuses and reasons we've been provided with and not the deaths of these poor, unfortunate souls who were merely doing a job. I genuinely struggled to come up with a name for this episode and then it became pretty obvious. So this is True Crime Tuesday, I'm Kevin Eustace, and after the break, we begin looking at an episode named The Trouble with Cars.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.
Now, we're going to go into a bit of a statistical land during the second part of this show, but it's intentional and it's required. We're going to start by saying, around this time of the Marconi deaths, The Independent, which is a newspaper in Britain, worked out that the suicide rate for Marconi scientists is twice the national average for mentally healthy people. So, is part of the criteria for joining Marconi that you have some sort of suicidal ideation? I doubt it. And also, we've proven in previous episodes that none of the victims shown any suicidal ideation. So why would it be double the national average? But believe me, that's not the most shocking statistic that we're going to reveal today. But right now, let's take a look at our first victim. And remember, all four of these people all died within the space of 4 months between the asphyxiation deaths of the last episode. Our first victim today is Victor Moore. Now, Victor was a 46-year-old designer-engineer from Marconi Space Systems, and he was found dead in February 1987. Officially, it was classed as an overdose. But the circumstances have sparked all the controversy and speculation that we'd expect from the Marconi murders, in inverted commas. And it should be said that Victor's suicide is the only one of the four that's not attached to a vehicle. So therefore, he kind of stands out from the title of the episode, but he's included because of the timeline of events. So Victor excelled academically and he had a passion for engineering. Graduating with honours from university, he quickly made his mark in the engineering field. And by the mid-80s, he was a key design engineer for Marconi Space Systems. And he worked on the advanced defence and aerospace projects. Now, roughly the first week or the start of February of that year, Moore was deeply involved in a very high-profile, very secretive project at Marconi. And his colleagues noticed he was working long hours, well into the night, and he was under high stress. Yet, despite this, he was known for his resilience and his dedication. Around the middle of the month, he attended a routine project meeting, but witnesses there said he seemed unusually anxious and distracted, and was very unlike his usual composed self. Now, I don't know about you guys, but I've sat in hundreds of team meetings, and I couldn't tell you if somebody was acting out of character, and if I could, it would be for a damn good reason, i.e. they've lost someone in their lives, they're going through some turmoil. You don't normally pick up on any change in behaviour from the people you work with. So for them to spot it means something has drastically changed within Victor's life. And the following day, Victor confided in a close friend that he had growing concerns about his own safety and the confidentiality of his project. Like a person we've mentioned previously, he also felt he was being watched, and he was worried himself about any potential leaks on what he was working on and their implications. In the following days, Victor's behaviour became increasingly erratic. He cancelled meetings, he called in sick. It was very unlike him. Neighbours would also report seeing unfamiliar cars around his home. On the 16th, he was last seen by his neighbour pacing outside his house and having a heated conversation with someone. A someone lost to the annals of time. The following day, the 17th of February, Victor Moore was found dead at his home. The official report said it was an overdose of prescription medication, and there were no immediate signs of any foul play, but the circumstances around his death obviously raised questions. The initial investigation concluded that Moore's death was a suicide. However, other factors led to further scrutiny. Moore had no history of depression, no suicidal tendencies. His friends and family were all very much shocked by the ruling, saying he had a very strong mental character, and he was ultimately dedicated beyond belief to his work. His recent behaviour did suggest significant stress at his job, though. It's puzzling, really. This man with no history of any mental health issues suddenly chooses to take an overdose. You do have to question what is going on. There's obviously a theory that posits Moore may have uncovered sensitive information. Information he should not have been privy to, which made him a target. Was he involved in SDI projects? Ones with national security implications? If so, was his death orchestrated to prevent any leaks? Did he actually know too much? And here's a very interesting point. His suicide, and as I say, out of many of the deaths we will look at, this is not necessarily black and white, but there are less red flags. Except, MI5 investigated his overdose. The report or the findings of this investigation are still classified today. Now, this involvement of MI5 definitely adds another layer of intrigue to his death. Why would a simple overdose lead to an investigation by such a high-level agency? If, God forbid, I took my own life, the chances of MI5 declaring an operation to investigate the cause of my death are zero. So, despite this appearing black and white and there are no red flags, this activity by MI5 makes it less black and white and more a bit of a slow blinking alarm. Forgive the unintended pun, but there is definitely more to this than meets the eye. But moving on, let's see what the trouble is with cars. We're going to first look at a man who arguably we have the least information about in all 22 of our victims. A man by the name of Edwin Skeels. In February 87, 43-year-old Edwin Skeels was an engineer working for Marconi and was found dead in his car. The official cause of death, carbon monoxide poisoning. And there was evidence showing he'd attached a hose to the exhaust of his car, fed it through the window, and sat there with the engine running. It was 1965 when he began his engineering education, and over the years, he honed his skills, becoming a perfectionist. Eventually, he secured a position at Marconi and was working on a very high-tech project. Throughout February 87, he continued at Marconi, and he'd shown no signs of distress, no unusual behaviour, this is according to his colleagues. However, on the 25th of February 1987, he was found dead in his car in his London home. The engine still running and the hose attached. However, it had a specifically modified part that allowed the hose to fit in the exhaust. By the end of February, the police had launched and basically closed its investigation into Skeels' death. Of course, it pointed towards suicide. And an autopsy in March confirmed that the cause of death was indeed carbon monoxide poisoning. And there was no indications of foul play, according to the official reports. Now, given the lack of information on this particular individual, this may well be an actual suicide. But we don't know what we don't know. And also this creation of a device only described as a modified connector raises the question of what that was. If he made it, well, why take the time? If your ultimate plan is to kill yourself, why not step out in front of a train? If he didn't make it, is this some piece of kit left behind by an assassin? I think we all know an attachment that fixes a hose to a car exhaust can't be bought in Asda or a Walmart. Arguably, this was a case, if we believe the theory that there are murders taking place, of them getting it almost perfect. Well, within the shit show of these 2 months, anyway. But without the information, it's hard to say. That said, sometimes the blanker the canvas, the more genius the painting. As we mentioned, we see not what's real, but what we're told our eyes are looking at. Although Edwin's death is officially classed as a suicide, there are obviously questions. And the coincidences, especially when we look at our next two cases within the same 2 months, are far too compelling to ignore. The month before Edwin's death, January 87, John Britton, who was a tank batteries expert for the MOD at the Royal Military College of Science, was also found dead by alleged suicide. In the months leading up to his death, John was reportedly under significant stress due to an increased workload at the Royal Military College of Science. His colleagues noticed he'd become more withdrawn, and he seemed under a lot of pressure. His work, which involved sensitive military technology, carried significant responsibility and potential risk. Friends and colleagues began to worry about John, his well-being, when he failed to show up for work. He stopped responding to calls. And then on the evening of January the 30th, 1987, the police found John's body in his car, parked in the garage of his home. The car was locked from the inside. And it appeared he died from carbon monoxide poisoning. A hose was attached to the car's exhaust, leading into the vehicle, and the engine had run until the fuel ran out. In the immediate aftermath, the police launched an investigation to determine the cause of death, and given his role at the MOD, there actually was immediate speculation there could be foul play. The autopsy, obviously, proved that he died of carbon monoxide poisoning, and again, there's no signs of a struggle or external injuries. So his death was treated as a suicide, and the media reflected this. However, some people would suggest that Britain was silenced due to his knowledge of military secrets. Others would go on to say he was just under immense pressure and chose to end his life to escape stress. The official investigation concluded that Britain's death was suicide. The evidence, including the locked car, the method of carbon monoxide poisoning, it all supported this conclusion. However, the fact he might have been perceived as a threat due to his knowledge of sensitive information is strongly debated. However, the narrative the media played to us and forced down our neck was the usual, now growing stale suggestion he was just stressed due to his work. But here's the thing. Although John Britton's wife did express concerns about the stress he now had due to his job, she even mentioned his raised anxiety and withdrawal in the weeks leading up to his death. Although she specifically recalls no idea or any expressing of a suicidal thought. In fact, his entire family in general was shocked by the suicide conclusion. They did not believe he would take his own life. That just wasn't the man they knew. Even colleagues reported that, although he seemed more withdrawn and preoccupied in the months prior, none of them reported any direct indications of any suicidal ideation. Close friends were even surprised by the suicide verdict, noting that though, yes, stressed, he still would go out to social activities, and there was no indication or communication in regard to any intent to self-harm. Another investigation uncovered zero history of any mental health issues or suicidal tendencies in John's medical records. The lack of concrete evidence pointing to suicide, especially given the highly sensitive nature of his work, certainly leaves room for speculation. So, is there more to the story than we know? Well, while there are obvious observations that he had increased stress and anxiety and withdrawal, there's also no concrete evidence or testimony to suggest that John had any suicidal ideation prior to his death. And the mixed reactions of his friends and family, combined with the circumstances of his work, well, it makes for a very interesting, thought-provoking case. But arguably not as thought-provoking as our final victim, Peter Peeple. On the night of February the 22nd, 1987, tragedy struck at the home of Peter Peeple. Peter was a respected expert in communications technology and electronic surveillance. Peeple, aged 46, was also employed at the Royal Military College of Science, where he was renowned for his work in signal processing and testing the explosive resistance of titanium. He went out with his wife that evening, had a lovely time, and drove home. As he and his wife Maureen were driving home, Peter mentioned he could hear a strange sound coming from the car. When they arrived back home, Peter went to park the car, and Maureen retired to bed. Slightly inebriated, she was out like a light, and expected Peter to be up shortly after. The following morning, however, Maureen awoke to find she was alone. So she searches the house, and eventually she makes her way to the garage. Now, despite the car door being closed, there's no one in it, but the car engine is running. To her horror, she finds Peter laying on his back underneath the car with his neck arched awkwardly at a 90-degree angle, the back of his head against the back wall, and his mouth positioned directly below the tailpipe. She pulled him out into the open air, but it was far too late. Peter was already dead. Initially, Maureen believed Peter's death was an unfortunate accident. She speculated he'd crawled under the car to investigate the noise he heard whilst driving home and somehow got trapped. But there are inconsistencies. You see, the garage light was broken, but Peter didn't have a flashlight or a torch on him. Meaning, if we follow the idea that he's gone under the car to investigate the noise, he's done so in complete and total darkness. Even the police had their own doubts about the accidental nature of Peter's death. An officer of a similar build to Peter attempted to crawl under the car with the garage door closed, as allegedly Peter did, but the tiny space left by the car made that feat impossible. Furthermore, closing the car door from beneath the car was also not possible. The presence of carbon deposits on the inside of the garage door also indicated that the engine had only been running for a brief period. Now that's puzzling because it was running when Maureen walked in, 7 hours after she'd gone to bed. The coroner's inquest was unable to determine whether Peter's death was a homicide, suicide, or an accident. But Maureen insisted that Peter had no reason to take his own life. There were no signs of marital or financial distress. Peter was thriving at work. He'd recently received a substantial raise, and he'd shown no signs of stress, according to all of his colleagues. She refused to accept that outcome, believing it publicly, stating publicly that this was murder, and she demanded a meeting with law enforcement regarding the matter, which she had. And she's remained silent ever since that meeting. Even the coroner's officer is quoted as saying, "Most people who kill themselves in this way use a hose from the exhaust through a window and sit in the car. This case just does not fit." So there we have it. 2 months, 4 deaths. The narrative all pushed towards suicide. 3 of the 4, carbon monoxide poisoning from car exhausts. Well, here's an interesting statistic. When you look at suicide from 2010 to 2023, roughly 5% are via suicide in that method. So if you do the math, for 3/4 of these suicides to be carried out in that way, are you ready? It's a 2,100-to-1 chance. Yeah, so you listening to this right now, yes you, your odds of being struck by lightning within this year are 1,220-to-1. So, officially, it's 64% more likely that you'll be struck by lightning this year than what we've been told to believe is true. Interesting, eh? Whilst we're on statistics, did you know, and I didn't, and I found this fascinating, that roughly only 30% of suicides leave a note behind? So roughly under 1 in 3. Now I was surprised by that. I wasn't surprised to find there was not a single note left by any of our 4 deaths today. Now for next week, we'll just tease that episode with 2 facts. Fact number 1. We know that one of the leading scientists looking into remotely operated vehicles has allegedly already been suicided in an earlier episode. So from that, we can surmise that that's an area of interest to someone. And fact two, next week, we look at yet more deaths. One in particular is a car whose driver had just received the news of an impending promotion and had the world at his feet. Yet, he decided, at a spur-of-the-moment decision, of course, to suddenly drive across several lanes of traffic and smash headfirst into a storefront. Oh, and as we all do, of course, in case of emergencies, he'd packed his trunk with as many cans of gasoline as it could hold, ensuring a detonation-style explosion on impact. But I'm sure next week we'll be told, of course, he was highly stressed at work, it's merely coincidence, please look away now. So that wraps up episode 4 of True Crime Tuesday, currently looking at the so-called Marconi murders. Join us next week, where we'll be telling you more about that man with a promotion who decided to end it all. In the meantime, take care of yourself, be safe, and if you enjoy the show, you can always head over to our Patreon at patreon.com/crimetuesday. There, not only will you receive these episodes both early and ad-free, but you can also gain access to the Patreon-only podcast Cold Case, where we take a look at some of the most infamous unsolved crimes throughout history. So if that sounds like your cup of tea, head over to patreon.com/crimetuesday. And until next week, take care.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.